Okay, are you sure?
Frankenstein's Army, I'm pretty sure.
No, I mean, are you sure you wanted to sign this?
Yeah.
All
Why
right.
wouldn't I?
Okay.
Are you worried?
No. Okay. These earbuds that I'm using now, they're like the Apple brand that came with my phone a million years ago, and I just started using them.
Are they good or horrible?
They're good, but they're weird. Like, if I don't, if, like, it can completely change how they sound depending on what angle they're at on my ear. Like, it can go from, like, they sound shitty to then I just, like, wiggle it a little and it sounds fine.
Yeah. We just got new phones, and the phones are awesome. But any, like, anything to do with audio is terrible on them.
Oh, that's interesting.
The speaker is, like, super tiny and not very good. The fucking headphones are terrible. Awful.
Like the ones that come with it?
Yeah, and yeah. Then I had to even download, like, another, like, music listening app. Because even that thing was, first of all, just really hideous. I just fucking hated looking at it. And two, it had, like, not very many features. And so it was just sort of weird. But I can draw in pictures now, so that's important.
Yeah, that'll work. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From Portland, Oregon, you are Richard Wally.
And from L.A., you are Cassidy Robinson.
How are you?
Do I have to say California?
No, you're fine.
Okay.
Are you, what's the heat situation in L.A. right now? Or
in L.A.? I don't know. What is it? Why did you tell me you live there?
Blistering.
Oh, okay. It's like 60, 65, I don't know, somewhere around there. Like, yeah, it's beautiful. It rained a lot yesterday. I could barely see where I was driving. It was kind of great, actually.
If only. They keep teasing this El Nino.
Mm-hmm.
We're supposed to get El Nino hardcore up in this. But he's taking his time. The little
that
boy.
Cheeky little boy.
He is taking his time to come and, I guess, flood the streets of Los Angeles. I don't know.
Sprinkle all over the place.
Right.
So.
All right. Today we're going to be reviewing The Martian and Sicario.
Sicario, yeah.
Sicario. I can't roll my R's.
You sound like you're saying, you don't need to. You sound like you're saying a cigarette in Spanish, not.
And at the end of the show, in our Netflix homework, we'll be reviewing the British film Barbarian Sound Studio. But before that, we didn't have a show last week, again.
Yeah, we didn't.
Mostly my fault. I'm going to say 90% my fault.
What's my 10%?
Oh, I'm sure you did something wrong. I don't know.
Well, I know I did do something wrong. I mean, obviously, but not. I don't even remember. I actually don't kind of remember why we didn't record. Like, I know we didn't, but I don't know why.
We usually record on Sunday nights, like we are now.
Yeah.
And.
Or Mondays.
Or Mondays.
Yeah, to be honest.
Yeah. We usually try and record on Sunday nights. I like to record on Sunday so I can use Monday to edit. But usually, you know, I'll push it for some reason or another, and I did that. I think I was with friends or something like that. Oh, we'll do it tomorrow. Not realizing that Monday and Tuesday at my work, things were going to be crazy. Absolutely insane. We did a big event over at a fancy hotel in Beverly Hills, which is basically like this tech conference. Where a bunch of Hollywood / technology types come together and talk about the future of the industry in some fashion or another. And me and the other guy who run the Power Grid, which is the sister site of the RAP that I work for, we had to volunteer one of those days. So one of the days I was running the Power Grid all by myself while he was there. And then on Tuesday, it was vice versa. And then the next day, I had to wake up at like 6 o'clock to be at the hotel by 7 a.m. And I was just kind of a gopher, you know, move this box here, make sure you don't let people through this door, da-da-da-da-da. My job kept changing about every 25 minutes. And then for a lot of it, they didn't really have much for me to do, so I would just sit in on the panels. Right. At one point, there was a drone flying around.
Yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah, there was a whole thing about, like, how drone technology is going to, like, change filmmaking. And it probably will. It's a lot cheaper to helicopter a drone than to do actual helicopter shots.
Well, or use a crane. And you can get more of a mobility with a drone than you can a crane. So, I mean, no, it makes sense.
But the lead-up of it was really funny because they were, like, working on it in the back. And they'd built this up, like, really, really high. They're, like, you know, they show this big reel of all these crazy drone shots that people have gotten and, you know, all these like big exteriors and da da da. And then they were talking about how, like, to be a drone pilot, you have to be like a professional pilot and licensed, and it's not anybody can do it and all of this stuff. And then they, like, of course, try to get it going, and they had to vamp for time because they couldn't get it started.
Oh, my.
And it was just like a little interim thing between two panels. So it had to like go quickly. So it almost didn't happen at all. But finally it's like picks up and lifts off the ground, and it has like a camera. So you can watch what the camera is doing on the screen while it's flying around the room. Sure. And I was so expecting the scene from RoboCop with the Ed 209.
Like it just opened fire on everybody.
Yeah, it just like flew into somebody's face or something like that. Unfortunately, that didn't quite happen.
I'm sure it didn't. You see people flying around the little toy ones around here all the time. So it's just a thing that's going to happen.
I mean, back in the day, they used to just call them remote control helicopters. Is drone just like a new like tag word for it or something? Or is there a difference?
I don't really know, honestly.
It was outer.
I mean, there is a difference between, like, I don't know if there really is, just because I think it's just, like, the technology has gone further and can do more now. Like, I mean, even, like, that little toy, like, BB-88 from the new Star Wars movie, like an old remote control, you could stop the car, but, I mean, that thing will stop itself if it's about to run into something, or it will turn around, or it will, you know,
right, it has make a you a sandwich or whatever. It has a little bit of artificial intelligence. It's not going to, like, you know, wake up in the middle of the night and choke you or anything like that.
Yeah, it has radar. I don't know if it's artificial intelligence.
But it knows, like, how to not bump into walls or something like that, yeah.
You can control it
with your iPhone instead of an actual paddle. They say it's going to be this year's Furby. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm so far removed. I don't have a child. I don't care. But is that a good answer?
Have you seen it in action?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, I saw it at the Long Beach Comic Con. That was the first time I saw it, and people were playing with it. It's like $300 a piece.
Yeah. I mean, I get it, but I don't get it. Like, I mean, I mean, the Nintendo was like $100 back in like 1990, and I had one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not exactly the same, but it's the most comparable thing you could at the time. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So. I mean, during those weird Christmas rushes where even something like a Tickle Me Elmo or a Furby, which is worth maybe $20, end up, you know, being sold in back alleys for $300.
Right. And I don't know. My family was never, didn't have the money for that. And two, just like, it's just not. It just seems like foolishness. So
I had a Furby.
I'm sure you did.
I did, but I got the Furby during the Furby year. But you know,
did you touch your Furby?
Yeah, you had to. You had to poke it in the belly to feed it.
I bet you did.
It actually sort of freaked me out. I wasn't way into it. Once I actually had it, it was sort of unnerving. I think I played with it for like 2 weeks, and then it went in a box in the closet for pretty much forever.
What year was that came out?
Oh, that would have been like 98, 99.
So how old were we then?
Like 12. 12, 13, something like that. And I'm convinced that the reason that like blew up the way it did is because there was a whole generation who was raised on Gremlins who wanted a Mogwai for all of their life. And then this toy came out, and they also marketed like, oh, you can teach it things and words and it will get to know you. And so obviously it was really limited. Like there was just a pool of words it could learn. And, you know, it was kind of scheduled the more you played with it to advance as it went. Mm-hmm. And there was a ceiling to how much it could learn, obviously. But, you know, the way they sold it was like, you're going to have a robot friend. That looks like a Mogwai.
I think by 12 I was.
You were too cool. You were like skateboarding and making out with girls, and
I don't know what grade is that. That's like sixth grade. I think I was actually. That's when I became a closet nerd, and I was still getting like Spider-Man toys, but then not like talking about it, just playing with them after school.
We'll go ahead and get into the last 2 weeks worth of movie news, and I'll let you start.
So that Marvel Studios, they put out a movie every, you know, three months a year. So. But for Thor 3, they've set a director. The director is going to be Takeo Waititi. Do you know who that is?
Yeah.
I do too, but I'm just checking.
He is the New Zealand director who did What We Do in the Shadows.
Correct. He did What We Did in the Shadows. I think Eagle versus Shark is the other movie he did. We just watched that not too long ago. And he did quite a few of the Flight of the Conchord episodes, actually, too.
Yeah.
He's funny. He has a very quirky sense of movie making. Mm-hmm. He also does a thing where he makes the most awkward characters ever. So my version of his Thor in my head is very strange.
Right. Yeah. Well, one could say that one of the reasons they got this guy, I don't necessarily think this, but one could say, is because Alan Taylor, who did the last one and who also did the last Terminator movie, this is a little self-serious, I think. Sure. Certainly more so than the Kenneth Branagh one. And there was something about it that was good enough, but it sort of fell flat.
It was lackluster.
Yeah, it was fine, but it didn't really leave much of a lasting impression. And there was something about it that was, this was during the period of time where everything had to be dark and gritty and had to have the word dark in the title.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was a little bit of that carried over. Like, I'm sure that was kind of his assignment. But I think now they're sort of backtracking on that, obviously, with something like Ant-Man, which skews much more comedic, much lighter, lower stakes, da-da-da. They might be trying to pull that in with Thor as well. So they get, you know, a light comedic director.
Well, Thor's always been like a hard character. I mean, even in comics, has been a hard character to adapt. There's been several interesting interpretations as well. So, it makes sense that they're kind of like, well, maybe we could try this. Well, maybe we could try this. But specifically with that too, I know that there was some their first director that they wanted on the project. She ended up not wanting to do it. And then they got Alan Taylor on, and I know that there was kind of some back and forth between him and the studio that they didn't really, it's not that they didn't get along, it's just that they didn't really always agree what the movie should be.
You heard little things about what was going on or whatever, and the end product kind of seemed to mirror that. I don't think that they hired this guy for comedic chuckles and because of what he's shown with his films. I think they hired him because he's cheap.
That is a mercenary way to look at it, and it may be true. Like, I mean, truthfully, he has sort of a weird kind of sense to him. And I mean, they kind of have a habit of getting more unknowns. And so maybe that is just an economic thing. But I mean, at this point, I don't think so. I don't think they need to do that. I think the reason they do it is because it's just like, it's interesting. I think it's more interesting choice than getting some just like B movie action-y kind of thing.
Right.
I think it's more interesting than getting a DJ Caruso or something like that, somebody like that on the project.
Right, yeah, or Brett Ratner, you know, so, yeah, I know what you're saying.
I bet they could get somebody just like that just as cheap, if not cheaper. And I mean, he's going to be cheap. He's made like three movies and they've been like super micro-budgeted things.
I think it's a combination of a thing. I don't think they're just looking for cheap. I think they like the fact that he's a name, that he has... Not a huge name, like, but right. That he has a certain kind of cult audience that speaks to specifically a Comic-Con type crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they kind of look for that, like, you know, getting guys who are connected to Community or a guy who's connected to Game of Thrones. But and so, like, they have a property attached that they might have an audience attached to.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not so big and they haven't made so much money for so many people that they're going to come in there and own the place. Like, that, you know, they can still, you know, bow to a studio.
Right. Well,
so I think they're looking for a kind of specific blend of, you know, people who want to work and will do it for pretty cheap, but who might have a little bit of a, like, an interest outside of just the Marvel property.
Yeah, or, and I think maybe an interesting, semi-interesting catalog, you know?
Yeah.
Something that has a little bit more pizzazz than just your average just workman's director.
Right.
To me, it's still a little bit of a strange choice.
not too far off from what we're already talking about. F. Gary Gray, who just did Straight Outta Compton and has done The Negotiator and Friday and Be Cool, blah, blah, blah. He has been hired to do the next Fast and the Furious movie, Furious 8.
And but that one makes more sense to me.
Yeah, that kind of makes a great deal of sense. One, he's done action movies.
Right.
And he's, you know, kind of a fairly well-known director. Maybe a little workman, but you know, he certainly... has proven himself to be, you know, successful box office and these kinds of things. And he's just had a huge success with a semi-personal film. And so he's kind of proven himself that he can make a lot of money. And I don't know. Do you think it makes a little more sense than it did with who did the last one?
James Wan,
that's right. Do you think it makes more sense than that?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, not really. I think James Wan, you can look at his and say, oh, he has a competence in... While he's doing a horror film, he's also... You can see he's doing some serious editing and some serious, like, character work and stuff like that. So I think he has a little bit of... You can see that he has a little bit of chops, even if he is also sort of kind of a workman's more in the horror kind of genre, but
yeah,
you can tell that he has a little, he can be applied to other places and can work fine.
Right.
I think it makes a little more sense just with some of the properties he's already done and, with F Gary specifically. And maybe it's even a little bit better fit. I sort of liked how James Wan did the villain because it was literally like he did Jason Statham if he was like Dracula or something like that, like in the last Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
And that was kind of my favorite part, was just him like walking around like he could have had a knife and it could have been like a slasher movie.
Right.
But this one, it might be good too, just because I feel like he maybe has a little bit better understanding how to do like a little bit more of a nuanced version of maybe like the Ludacris and
Tyrese Gibson
Tyrese kind of Gibson kind of relationship.
Yeah.
I think he might be able to handle some of that stuff better. So honestly, I think it's one of the better choices that they've made.
Yeah, actually, you think about the idea of F. Gary Gray doing one of these movies, and you're kind of, it's kind of surprising he hasn't already.
Right.
Like, given that a big draw to the Furious movies, Fast and Furious movies, is the fact that it's a multiracial cast, mm-hmm. and it always has had a bit of an urban quality to it, even though now they're more or less like Mission Impossible, James Bond's world-trotting spies.
Right.
From
the streets.
Right, yeah. cars somehow have to get involved, but basically they're doing Mission Impossible missions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that he might be able to bring something there, and you know, I would even be interesting. I don't think this is what's going to happen, but it'd be interesting now that Paul Walker's not involved anymore, if maybe it did go back to something smaller scale and it was like just a car racing movie again that took place in LA.
Or even if it was just an, I agree with all the LA, but maybe even if it was, it had a bigger scale, but it just was a little bit more, I guess the word is not white. I don't really just, I feel like we're not trying to be, but it feels like we're being vaguely, like we're trying to code the language, even though we're not.
Right.
It just sounds silly. To be a little bit more like a little bit more street, if you will, or whatever.
Right.
I think that's an interesting idea. I don't, for this franchise, I think you could do anything. You could set it in the jungle. I mean, at this
space.
Point.
Yeah.
Yeah. They should do that. I'm always down for any of these kind of ridiculous concepts to go to space. So
what's your next story?
So the guy that did Snowpiercer, Bong Joon-ho, his next movie is supposed to be a multilingual kind of like a monster movie. And Tilda Swinton has already signed up and said, okay. They're also closing with Jake Gyllenhaal, Paul Dano, Kelly MacDonald, and Bill Nighy.
That is quite a cast.
Please, I hope they all join and they make a wonderful movie, because this Bong Joon-ho, he makes some pretty awesome movies, I have to say. So
he really does. Yeah.
I mean, his last cast, even though it wasn't, maybe it's not as star-studded as this next one, it was still a very interesting one. I mean, he had Chris Evans, Jamie Bell, Octavia Spencer, Ed Harris, Allison Pill, John Hurt, you know. There's a couple of well-knowns in there, so...
And a lot of different kind of flavors as far as, like, what all those character actors can do together.
Well, right. And that's the thing about this new cast, too, is just looking at them, is they can give some very interesting performances as well.
Mm-hmm.
Jake Gyllenhaal, while, you know, a pretty dude, he can give some interesting and very different performances.
I've been really, really into Jake Gyllenhaal lately. Like,
yeah.
The last few years, he's just... Like, I might not love everything he's in, but he's always picking really interesting stuff, and he's always going directly for the character. I think I was talking to some friends about it a while ago, and I likened it to, like, this was like Johnny Depp at his height.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, he's on that kind of a spree right now, where he's just taking really interesting work, and it's always kind of character-based, and, I'm really into what he's been doing.
Well, yeah, we've seen him go from everywhere from Super Bro... to awkward, not eating enough sociopath, you know.
we've seen
a big spectrum, and including some other like weirder performances too, like Prisoners, where we'll be talking about Sicario later today, so I had to bring this up. But
yeah.
He played this like kind of like this like shaky, weird, maybe former meth head detective.
And that's what I mean. Like he's always really interested in what his character choices are, and he also seems to be really interested in working with interesting directors,
mm-hmm.
and letting them kind of mold him. So yeah, I'm and the rest of that cast as well. It's just, I mean, Tilda Swinton's great in everything, and who else was in there?
Paul Dano. He'll be creepy.
Yeah, he'll do the... I'm a little over Paul Dano, but we'll see what happens with him.
Kelly MacDonald. I've seen her
cool
things. She's cool. But Bill Nighy's always fun. It's Bill Nighy.
Yeah, he's always great, and he's always 100% professional. Even if he does, you know, a schlocky, like, Underworld movie or something like that, he always puts 100% into it.
Well, and he's good in the part, no matter what, including the Underworld films, yes.
Right, yeah. I'm into it, and I think, you know, of all of the Korean New Wave dudes who's kind of come over and done American films, I think Bong Joon-ho has the most potential to have the most crossover success, because his stuff overseas is a little bit more populist, a little bit more kind of crowd pleasing, I guess. Maybe a little less esoteric, something like The Host or Memories of Murder, which is essentially kind of like a Seven Zodiac type thriller. So his stuff,
you had a professor that was specifically his, like, biographer or something.
Yeah, she was writing a book on him, and she'd interviewed him a few times, and
see, I didn't know. So in Korea, I don't mean this in a pejorative, but it just, he's a Michael Bay type almost. Not, he's probably not that bad, but I mean, he's a populist kind of guy.
Right. I mean, yeah, he makes movies that people like. I wouldn't go so far as to say Michael Bay. I'd say maybe more like a Spielberg.
Okay.
Like his stuff has an air of importance to it, but it's also like he can do big genre movies. I mean, Kim Ji-woon and Park Chan-wook also make genre movies, but maybe a little bit more in their way. Given how well Snowpiercer did, you know, despite the fact that it was practically shelved.
And it was a little weird.
And it's a little off kilter. Yeah, I think that's a good lead up to him having more success.
Well, the guy, which one is the one that did Stoker? Because I love that movie, but other people don't seem to get it.
That was Park Chan-wook who did Old Boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because there is kind of a surge of these kind of directors, you know, there is a standard for these guys coming over and making, you know, English movies with English actors. It's just,
yeah,
they don't stick because they have just some weird cultural and idiosyncratic things. At least it seems that way to us. But I can see what you're saying with him being the most, the one that's gelled the best. Also, I mean, he does something with a sense of humor, which I think is just something that, I don't know, appeals to American audiences in a way. So,
yeah.
Whereas those other guys are pretty, I don't know, they're pretty hard-edged. They have some sharp edges on their stuff.
Right. I think Kim Ji-woon has a little bit of that too, but it didn't play as well in The Last Stand. But he also didn't have a ton to work with there.
Mm.
All right, I'll go on to my last story. HBO is possibly going to be working with Zack Snyder on a Watchmen TV series. Zack Snyder already produced a Watchmen movie and has released several different cuts of it on DVD. Do you think this would be based on the extended Watchmen sequel stuff that DC just put out? Where does the story come from?
I don't know.
Is he going to just be taking another stab at the original 12 issues?
Maybe he just... what's weird to me is this, it echoes something, because originally Terry Gilliam tried to do this and tried to do it through HBO.
Yeah.
When he couldn't get a picture going, because he said the best way to adapt Watchmen would be into a TV series.
Yeah.
And so it seems weird that it kind of boils down to this point. And it still just feels wrong. Zack Snyder, he does a great job on the production end. Like, it looks nice, but we both tend to share the same agreement that the film is lacking in the actual context and what the book is actually trying to get into.
Yeah.
So it just seems bad. That's all it seems like to me, is like another... We don't need another version of his Watchmen. If he wants to come in as producer, that's one thing, and hand it over to somebody else. But I don't know. Where this is coming from, I mean, from what I understand, the DC stuff, the prequel stuff that's coming out,
right,
that has came out,
it was middling. It wasn't like some of it had a bigger success and some of it wasn't as good. So I don't really know, because I know that it got mixed reviews.
Right. So nobody, even in the comic world, which is the only world that knows about it, mm-hmm. is even clamoring for it.
And, you know, I would be totally up for Watchmen being interpreted by somebody more interesting and more maybe suited to the material.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I don't need another version that just looks pretty.
Right. We don't need another 200-minute music video.
Yeah.
That has a ton of production design and people in rubber costumes.
Right. And I mean, yes, I've heard them, you know, I've heard, what's his face, Patrick Wilson in interviews about saying how, like, painstaking they went to exactly create what a panel looked like in those. But that's always led to some of the more mediocre, like, interpretations of comics. Like, I was watching an interview with Drew Goddard recently, and he was like, you know, I believe that, and I agree with his kind of take on it, is you're doing your own run on that character, your own interpretation, your own thing. You have to be true to the character, but you have to bring something new to it. You have to do something with it. You can't just, you know, work on top of somebody. You can't just trace somebody else's drawings, basically.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not for it, and I don't know where it's coming from, because it doesn't. I mean, besides it could make money. And I know HBO is, since they got Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. you know, a pretty, I mean, it's not heavy, heavy fantasy, but it has a very, you know, they're making a genre show work, and then things like Walking Dead kind of taking off.
Yeah.
People are interested in doing genre on TV because they know they can make it work now. And this is maybe one of the first times that they can really make it work. Under a TV budget.
Yeah, they might just be taking the Watchmen world as established by the movie and expanding upon it with new scripts. I don't know what that would be.
See, you just made it uglier. Please, please don't give them ideas. Please don't say things like that.
All right, well, let's go ahead and get into the reviews. I'm going to review The Martian. Which you kind of nicely segued into me with the Drew Goddard thing, because he wrote it,
mm-hmm.
or rather he adapted it from a novel.
He wrote the screenplay, yeah.
Yeah, but he, by Andy Weir, wrote the novel, which right. apparently was somewhat of a success and bestseller, and people who were fans of the book were kind of excited to see it become a movie. It's directed by Ridley Scott, of the Alien franchise and Prometheus. Last year he did Exodus. And I've kind of realized, just watching this, like, he's been very prolific as of the last, you know, 10 or so years. He's practically been releasing a movie a year. And they're not little small Woody Allen $2 million things. We're talking, like, big productions.
Right.
Not always very great movies when you come out of it, but... certainly ambitious and certainly expensive and slick and, you know.
Well, I would say that they're not always... I wouldn't say that I've ever seen, like, a straight-up failure, though, either.
Oh, I think that The Counselor is pretty damn close to a straight-up failure.
Oh, well, we disagree with that, but I like that movie, and I'm one of very few I know, but I liked it.
And I'm not so sure about Exodus, either. But yeah, you know, he's talented enough that... And he's made such good movies in the past that he's one of those guys that you're just going to go and you're going to shill to see what he does because you remember the good movies. And I'm happy to say that The Martian is finally, after a few years of, you know, churning stuff out, is a pretty good movie with very few reservations. The basic plot is Matt Damon and a group of other scientists, Jessica Chastain and Michael Pena and a few other people, they go up to Mars to research and to, you know, plant some some tech up there in case they want to terraform at some point, and a giant storm hits them, and so they have to kind of leave in a rush, and while rushing to their spacecraft to get out of orbit, Matt Damon's character, Mark Watney, gets some debris, flings him far from the launch site of where everybody's going to take off, and he is left for dead by his crew. And then when he wakes up, he realizes, as does everyone else when he finally is able to reach Earth again, that it's going to be a minimum 4 years before he can be rescued. And luckily, he is the group's botanist, so he is able to kind of set up a little greenhouse in there and, through his wits and intelligence and knowings of how science and botany and weather and all of these different kinds of scientific practices work, he's able to essentially survive on minimal means. You know, just whatever was left there, and then a few other things he's able to find. And it becomes sort of a rescue mission by the second half of the movie. And there's one thing that really stood out to me with this movie right away. And we talked about Drew Goddard, who was one of the co-writers on Cabin in the Woods, and he also rebooted the Daredevil series for Netflix.
And he also helped write... Cloverfield. He directed Cabin in the Woods. He's
right.
He was one of the lost dudes.
Yeah, which kind of makes sense given that Ridley Scott worked with Damon Lindelof at one point. So that's probably might have been his connection. But one of the things I noticed right away was I was hearing something I never heard at a Ridley Scott movie before: laughter, and a lot of it. This movie's really funny. I'm not going to say, like, laugh out loud, you're going to, like, barf your lunch and pee your pants funny. It is essentially a drama of sorts, but there's a lot of really funny dialogue and quips and good timing, and it has kind of a sense of just bouncy levity to it all.
High standards for comedy.
Right.
That's to make you barf and...
That's your standard. If you don't throw up on your shirt and piss your pants, then it's not a successful comedy. This is a little lighter on things than Ridley Scott normally goes, which his stuff is usually very kind of stately and classically approached and a little monolithic sometimes. And in doing so, maybe a little stiff. But this isn't like that at all. One of the gags in the movie is that Jessica Chastain's character, when she was the group commander or whatever, she was the head of their launch, and the only music she left was disco music, like 70s disco music. So the whole movie is scored by disco music. Burn Baby Burn and ABBA and... Kristen Wiig is in here, so she gets to... I mean, she's not doing, like, a big, loud Saturday Night Live character, but she brings a little bit of what she can do into it as well. And I just kind of liked this movie. It's not as high stakes as something like Gravity as far as these space survival movies go.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in a way that's smart, because coming so soon from that, I think there's certain sequences.
Interstellar.
And there's some stuff, weird plot stuff that kind of echoes in this movie from both of those movies, specifically the last third. But I think the fact that it tonally is so different and the character is so different than his character in Interstellar is, like the Sandra Bullock character from Gravity or whatever. And the stakes are, maybe it's a little bit more Castaway in some ways.
Would you say that one of the big reasons why this is maybe a bigger hit is because Drew Goddard wrote it?
The screenplay is a big help to it. Mm-hmm. And I think just one of the major things about the movie that I really liked about it is that even though it's about like this survival and this kind of, you know, Call of the Wild on Mars thing going mm-hmm. on, even though that's sort of what's going on in this movie, and you could do that very bleak if you wanted to, the movie is really optimistic, and not just optimistic about the character, but optimistic about everything. It puts a lot of faith into what people with great minds can do under stress, and you know, the true power of science. And
well, I know that Drew Goddard was really, like, he one really liked the book, and then two, he did write the screenplay with the mind to direct it. Mm-hmm. But then he went to do a Spider-Man movie because it's been his dream since he was a child to do a Spider-Man movie. So,
right.
But I think Drew Goddard is one of the more talented and, one of the less, because all the Lost guys are genre guys really.
Yeah.
But he's one of the ones that I think knows how to handle it the best. And I think that he going on to the future, as long as he gets stuff produced and put out there, I think he should be the biggest star from that.
Well, and it certainly seems after this that he very well could be. But, you know, I don't want to just put everything on his shoulders and say that it had, you know, that Ridley Scott brings nothing to it, because of course he brings what he can do. It looks fantastic.
It's fucking Ridley Scott. I don't think he even have to explain why
and,
he made
you know, it. The direction of actors and things like that, and he's able to pull out real performances and he's able to milk the drama where it needs to be. But I think the thing that does stick out to me the most is how fun it was. This is a fun movie. Certainly more fun than Interstellar. Maybe not as impactful or as visceral as Gravity, if we're going to compare the two, and certainly other people will, but it's definitely the most fun of all three.
Well, that's good. I was hoping, I've heard good things, and so hopefully I can catch up with that one eventually.
Yeah, this is going to be one of those movies I think that like high school and middle school science teachers are going to show clips from to explain certain scientific theories and different laws of science and how things work and that kind of stuff, because there's a lot of like little science lessons all the way through. It was like, oh well, I just ran out of oxygen, so I have to build this thing, and this is kind of how it works, because he does these little video logs and things as it's going, which you would think might be kind of annoying, but actually that's all played in a really casual and fun way as well.
Good to hear.
I enjoyed it. Let's go ahead and get into our second review, which is Denis Villeneuve's Sicario.
Mm-hmm. Sicario. And
I'll let you set that up.
Okay. Sicario is a crime thriller of sorts. It's set on the Mexican border, cartel stuff. This whole setup, we've seen it before. But the movie follows a young FBI agent and how she kind of gets entrapped and kind of brought into a bigger, larger CIA cartel happenings on the border world.
Right.
It stars Emily Blunt is the main character. And it also has Josh Brolin. He plays a super spook, and Benicio del Toro, who plays a super, super, super spook. this movie is one of the most economically tense movies I've ever seen. The dialogue is economic. Everything is just, it was like I was having a slow motion heart attack while I was watching it. I really, really liked it. I think that, the way it transgresses and some of the issues it talks about are very interesting. And, even though it doesn't spend a lot of time at it, it gives you like interesting points of reference, and it does it dead on. Like sometimes you'd be like in another movie, you'd be like, that's a little bit on the nose. But for me, it was like, nope, it's just a punch in the face that's needed to happen. And, the acting all around is interesting. The world, I think it brings you in really quick. And, I really dug it. I am been a fan of this Dennis Villeneuve since Prisoners, which it hasn't been too long. I thought that movie was kind of like a throwback to like a Night of the Hunter type kind of thriller, where it's kind of almost like a fairy tale-y. Mm-hmm. His next movie, The Enemy with Jake Gyllenhaal, it was an interesting mess. It wasn't necessarily as good. But it definitely showed what he can do with technique and color and camera, and he's more and he's just as interested in doing that stuff as he is here. But here it seems like he's the most collected, the most focused, and I think this might be one of his most populist movies. But I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that it really is a pretty kind of tense throwback kind of thriller, like you'd go to like Silence of the Lambs or something like that. So.
Yeah, I thought a lot about Silence of the Lambs while watching this movie, not just because the main character is a female, but structurally, there's a lot of Silence of the Lambs-esque things going on in this movie. Right. I fucking love this movie.
Yeah, yeah.
I would be very surprised if this didn't end up in my top 5 or at least my top 10 by the end of the year. This is masterclass filmmaking. And you're right in that, you know, I wrote my review up for this already and probably post it later tonight or tomorrow. But, you know, I said that this is really well-worn territory. Even the idea of the Southwest noir, we've even seen recently done to great effect by the Coen brothers in No Country for Old Men. With Josh Brolin, which is another movie I thought a lot about, in part because both films were shot by Roger Deakins, who, in my mind, is the best working cinematographer right now. All of his stuff, who also shot Prisoners, all of his stuff is absolutely beautiful, gorgeous, and meaningful, and he knows how to light something very, you know, with natural lighting and using the sunset and magic hour lighting.
Well, and this movie showcases that even more.
Yeah, and I think there's a really good harmony between him and Dennis Villeneuve, who knows how to milk the drama from every single setup. The very first setup of the movie, which might be one of my favorite opening set pieces I've seen this year, of Emily Blunt's team breaking into this drug house in the middle of the desert, and, you know, it's kind of done in this first person sort of halo camera sort of way. But, you know, we really don't know what's around every corner until she actually turns those corners. And, you know, the way he establishes shots with these big, big kind of ominous, helicopter shots and this kind of stuff, he creates this world that seems to have a personality of its own. And as she, you know, enters this world and she sort of doesn't know what she's getting into. She's, you know, she comes from this very moralistic place of, I just want to do the right thing and I want to get the bad guys. And she has this very black and white view of how this world of crime works. And then she goes, you know, further and further into the, you know, the circles of hell. She realizes that morality has nothing to do with anything in this world.
Well, it's more complex than that. Like the morality is more complex than just there's not a simple binary here, and it's not this simple like boil down. To me, this movie, if we're getting into like subtext and stuff like this, this movie is kind of our Emily Blunt is almost our like surrogate to how people think about immigration,
right?
Good, bad, oh, scary, like mafioso, the cartel people. And then the Josh Brolin character and the Benicio del Toro character, which, holy shit, I applaud him.
Like all his, three. I think this is I think this is the best work I've seen from all three of these actors, maybe ever, but definitely in a long time.
Well, while I really love Emily Blunt and I really love Josh Brolin in this, for me, Benicio del Toro was just so, I mean, it's partially his character. Like, let's be honest, like it is partially what he is in the movie that makes his character so interesting and so You're just a moth to the flame to his character.
Right. Because he's shrouded in mystery and he really gets to play it, you know, totally cool. And he's terrifying.
He's absolutely terrifying. And that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we get the Silence of the Lambs stuff coming from.
Well, there's a whole sense of dread to the whole movie.
Yeah. When I say slow motion heart attack, I really mean it. Like my hand was on the seat and it was like just tensing throughout the whole movie.
I mean, it was one of those movies. This only happens a few times a year, which is how I know it's as good as I'm saying it is.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was leaning into my seat, just soaking every single moment. And it's a deliberately paced movie. It's not rushing to anything. And there's it lets you wait for a good while before things start to happen. But it's so good at building atmosphere and it's so good at world building and setting a sense of paranoia to everything.
Well, when I say economic too, there wasn't wasted plot.
No,
it's lean. It's also the dialogue. The dialogue was the most impressive part to me, like how lean it was, because it was just like, again, everything they said was impactful or it was pointing you or doing something. And right. You don't watch movies like even some of the best movies don't do this. So I think this is really just a triumph of a movie. And I feel like really stupid saying that because it's like very, you know, big and whatever, but it is, it's a great movie. And so if you're into this kind of like crime noir stuff, you'll like it. If you aren't, I think you might still like it. It's a good movie.
Right. And I want to champion this as much as possible because I feel like the marketing was a little kind of, I don't know. I've told a lot of people how I felt about it just because I've been that excited about it that I've just been like, you know, as soon as I walked out of the movie theater, I texted our friend Keith and I was just like, Sicario, go, don't walk, run to the theater right now.
Right.
And he was like, really? I didn't know. I was kind of on the fence about it. And then I told some other friends and they were like, I don't know. It looked like a generic action movie to me. I'm like, it's not. Go, 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 go.
No. It is. It's better than that. And besides that, I mean, I think you're right that the previews don't represent it clearly. But at the same time, I wouldn't have from a preview wanted to be given more. I love being sucked into the movie how you were and not told what was happening because you needed that sense of mystery and dread and everything that you got from it. Now, again, I was really excited from this movie from the get-go because, again, I've been following Denis Villeneuve since Prisoners.
Yeah.
So also I'm slightly I think Emily Blunt is a badass and I like watching her in film. So there were a few things that I was like, okay, definitely these are the reasons why I want to go see it.
Yeah, it has a good cast and the director is very exciting, but I think I was even knowing that, I was kind of unprepared by how great this movie is.
Oh, well, still agreed because even though I've been into him, I wasn't, you know, like Prisoners, there was some stuff it was not nearly as lean, it was not nearly as just sharp as this movie is.
Prisoners, I don't think I liked it near as much as you did. I thought that it was very, very well made. I thought there was some hokey story stuff. But I think this movie is a perfect marriage of screenplay, cinematography, acting. It's just everything is humming in harmony.
Agreed. I'm just telling people to go see it. That's it.
Yes.
If you like movies, you should go see this.
It is very violent.
Yeah. So I guess if you don't like violence, but
I don't say that it's a caveat. I think that I think that it's part of what the movie is, and the movie in a large part is about violence.
Well, let's get back to the subtext that's there.
Sure.
There's something that's very important about that. So if Emily Blunt is that basic, you know, black white, right, our version of our side of the border.
Yeah, she's the moral center of the movie.
They also have this other side plot that's going on with just a simple Mexican police federale who's on the other side of the border, and they follow him.
Yeah, and then it cuts to it a couple times, and you're not ever sure what it's about. You know it's going to tie in, maybe, but...
Well, when it ties in, it's perfectly sums up the difference between here on this side of the border and on the other side of their side of the story in Mexico. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for people to see it and to kind of really look at that and think about that, those scenes and those parts. There's specifically something that I found very, very interesting just in the fact that they're like, when we get caught up in these, the immigration debate, we never talk about how there are broader and scarier implications to things in this debate. And there are things that just go on the wayside. And while on our side, things are safe and cuddly and perfect, on their side, there is death and violence and things like that. And we, you know, getting into, like, since we're talking about the cartel as well, and we're talking about drugs, there are some very, it's party, but then you're funding something that's ugly and large. You're funding an industry that kills people like this.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be like harping on people or whatever, or being like anti-drug daddy or anything like that. But I think it brings up some interesting moral questions about how we treat immigration and how we treat drugs in this country.
Just a general sense of American white privilege.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. We're able to kind of turn our heads and not really think about these things because we don't have to.
Well, and this I feel like it's not judgmental about it. I think it's just presenting this is what it is.
Right.
That's another thing that I like about it.
But there's also something, there's also something a little arch and a little symbolic about the way the movie's shot and the way the movie plays that I don't think is necessary. This isn't a docudrama.
No.
You know, this isn't like, you know, taking you into the world like as it really is. It's telling, you know, kind of a very large scale, somewhat operatic movie.
I would say the Prisoner gives you an idea of what he's doing here.
Because yeah.
Prisoners is also kind of it's kind of a cautionary, not a cautionary tale exactly, but it's kind of a moral tell. It's an own allegory, not exactly, but it's akin to those things.
Right.
It is telling you something about our world.
Right. And this movie kind of plays in the same kind of symbolic way of how he uses visuals and how he sets up shots and how he, you know, like, you know, he does turn, what city were they in when they pass through?
El Paso?
El Paso. Well, when they go through El Paso. Yes. When they go into Juarez, he kind of turns the city into this, like I said, this circle of hell. And as they go deeper, it gets worse and worse and worse. I can't say enough good things about this movie. I really think this is likely to be one of the best films of the year.
Yeah, I think so easily. I still don't feel like we're selling it well enough.
No, weird? I know.
Even though we're literally spitting out every word we can think of that's good. Like, this movie is better than that. Just go see the motherfucker, please. Yes, yes.
All right, well, let's get into the last review then, our Netflix homework, which is Barbarian Sound Studio. And this was kind of part of the idea that we're going to be doing Halloween-themed or horror films for the month. And this is kind of a strange movie to wrap your head around. Even kind of recently seeing it, I watched, you know, the majority of it yesterday. This is written and directed by Peter Strickland. Toby Jones plays the lead character, and it kind of takes place, I want to say, around the late 60s, early 70s. Toby Jones plays a sound engineer who's hired by an Italian horror film production to do the sound mixing and Foley editing on set. You know, there's a lot of, like, little cineast... little knowledge kind of things in here. If you know a lot about, like, horror film, you know specifically about how Italian productions work back then,
and Giallo,
like,
kind of
Giallo film and that kind of stuff, you'll get a lot more out of this movie. And one of the things going into this movie that I think helped to know is that a lot of Italian productions, 90% of the sound is always done after the fact, including dialogue. So you'll have your actors. And if you've seen, like, Suspiria, or you've seen some, like, Mario Bava films or something like that, you'll probably seen this where they're mouthing the right words. It's not like old Godzilla movies. They're mouthing the words, but it's clear that the audio is ADR.
Well, you also, it's weird too, because you'll get half and half. You'll get English speakers and you'll get full Italian speakers.
Yeah.
Or people who do a mixture of both. And right. those are the most fun, because sometimes you're never sure what language they're really speaking. But
And there's something kind of otherworldly about that style when it happens.
Well, it's all atmosphere. It's not very plot driven.
No,
it's very much about the feeling of fear, not the trying to trick you and boo scares and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's not maybe as much narrative technique going on, but there's a lot of like, you know, lighting and a lot of like we were talking about with the last film, a lot of like symbolic stuff, kind of more just, yeah, creating sort of an atmosphere or a sense of dread. And a lot of it's done through the sound design. So this right. movie really plays not only with the movie within the movie sound design, which, you know, which is a lot of what's going on here, is just him in the studio. And this is one of those movies that's going to change the way you look at vegetables and fruit for a long time. Because they're like hacking away at like you know, melons and lettuce and all of this stuff to create these stabbing and chopping sound effects, but the way it's shot, they shoot it specifically to look like a gore scene. And one of the clever things, I think one of the most clever things about this movie, is they never actually show the movie within the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You always see the flickering in the background and you see the characters watching it, but you never, you just kind of get an idea of what's going on through little hints of dialogue or whatever. But well, what did you think of Barbarian Sound Studio?
Well, I'm a big fan of giallo, and they do a nice like homage to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then it also kind of breaks down into more like kind of, I guess, a like Lynchian type.
Yes.
Surrealism.
Very much
is
so.
The best way to say it. I knew that it did that. That being said, I found the atmospheric stuff to be better than, I don't know. This movie was kind of half and half for me. I thought it was interesting from a being a fan of that kind of horror, but at the same time, I was a little just because when it broke down to the surrealistic qualities, mm-hmm. it did it so in a way that was, I just didn't follow it very well. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because it's a mix between the two, like it goes from very realistic into surrealistic. But I don't know. I also, the other problem is I was looking for something a little bit more rock and roll. And when you show me giallo horror stuff and then I don't get that, I get disappointed. Like it's sad, but that's what happened. Like I can't say that that's an honest, like a very objective point of view on this, mm-hmm. because there were a lot of things that I was just like, oh, I didn't go there. Oh, it didn't. This didn't happen. That being said, it does have some very creepy atmospherics. There's some weird stuff going on between with specifically with language divide.
Yeah.
And how that can really make people feel isolated and feel kind of strange. Also being in, you know, having that happen to me before.
Yeah.
I guess so. To me, it seemed more natural. I was also picking up a lot of the Italian, so that didn't, I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's subtitled.
It was subtitled, but I sometimes wasn't reading it.
Oh, okay.
Because I didn't need to. So, I mean, the film itself, I don't know. The ending, how it broke down and got weird, I don't think it was done poorly. I just didn't get much from it. So maybe on a subsequent viewing, maybe,
mm-hmm.
I would appreciate it more. But on this first viewing, I was just, which, you know what, like, to be honest, with surrealistic films, sometimes that happens.
Right.
I'm just like, okay, whatever. The vegetable stuff, though, you're right, was good.
I kind of agree with you. I think my takeaway is a little better than yours, or not better, but a little more positive than yours.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that I was a lot more into the first half than the second half. There's a lot of Lynch in this movie, certainly, and not just in the non-linear fracturing narrative, you know, splintering weirdness that kind of happens towards the second half of the movie where the plot sort of folds in on itself. Mm-hmm. In a way that I felt was a little unsatisfying.
It was that, that's a good word. Actually is I just felt unsatisfied by the ending. I was like, that happened. Okay.
Right. But the other movie I thought a lot about while I was watching this, it's not an Italian film and not a Lynch film, is the Coen brothers, Barton Fink. And, okay. And that, that kind of sense of weird atmosphere and kind of otherworldliness within the industry while also sort of commenting on the industry and being sort of cine literate about its time and it's in the genre that it's playing around in. And being a movie about movies and that kind of stuff. So I thought a lot about Barton Fink and sort of the character, Toby Jones's character and his place in this world. He's certainly not as egomaniacal as the Barton Fink character. but he does have that kind of stranger in a strange land kind of vibe going through this movie. And I was really enjoying it on that level for about 2/3. And then when the movie, I felt like it defaulted to Lynchian weirdness, because it didn't know what to do. Like it didn't know how to land the plane. And maybe on subsequent viewings, like you were saying, I could get more out of it and see like, oh, they're actually doing this, or there was something in the beginning of the movie that I wasn't paying attention to that actually is much more important than I realized. That could very much be the case. And it's made so well that I'm willing to give it the benefit of the doubt that there probably was some stuff that I was reading into wrong or not reading into at all. I can't deny the fact that by the last 15 minutes, I was kind of like, where did the movie go? It kind of vaporized in front of my eyes.
Right. I've seen other things that have satisfied these qualities in a more interesting way.
Right. I would say, if I just want to keep pulling movies out of my ass, if you think of like, Nicholas Winding Refn's, what was that one with John Turturro? Speaking of Barton Fink,
something Citizen X.
Citizen, was it Citizen X?
I want to say, I don't think Citizen, that's what it was called, but it might not be.
I thought a little bit of that movie too, where it was like, it knew how to do the style and it had this idea of like, oh, I'm going to do like a Lost Highway ish movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel Fear like
X.
Fear X. Yeah. I felt a lot like that movie did with this movie. They kind of use that language, but to not as good effect. Like, you know, you can say whatever you like about David Lynch movies, in how indecipherable or impenetrable they might be. Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive, there's something about those movies that when it's said and done, even if you're totally confused and befuddled and your hands are in the air, there's something seductive about those movies that makes you want to watch them again. It makes you want to sit down with a pen and paper and a flow chart to figure out what the fuck you just saw. Whereas this movie, I don't know if it really has that. It felt like it was just like, and then, you know, somebody in the script, right? And then everything gets weird.
Right. It's the first half, the first 2/3, as you said, is much more interesting. And I could never get back out of that. Like, I just, weird stuff started happening. I was like, okay, weird stuff's happening now. And that's as deep and as far as my interpretation went.
Right.
I tried to kind of dissect it a little, but
visually, I think it does, like, you know, the dream logic and the you know, even before it gets into the narrative craziness, it uses lighting and sound and that kind of stuff. And even like those chopping scenes, there is a kind of a surreal sense to those scenes as well. But I felt like in a more kind of balanced way. And yeah, I don't know. Narratively, it's a little disappointing, but I think that it's interesting enough that I recommend the movie because aesthetically, it's so unique and it's, you know, the kind of the peek into the film history is interesting as well.
I think if you maybe are interested in it, but I don't know. I just rather watch Giallo. I mean, even if we're talking about that second half, like it is still reminiscent of those movies because sometimes they get chopped up really choppy and kind of nonsensical.
Right.
there was something interesting. The little parts that I was kind of like more interested in with the more surrealistic stuff was his character started speaking in Italian and was subtitled. And that sort of stuff, like, verged on kind of like a Stockholm syndrome kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the things that I was kind of looking at just kind of broke down. So I was like, it depends on what you want. This is not like, I see it in a lot of like best horror lists. Mm-hmm. And I think it has some good qualities, but it has some good atmospheric qualities in the way it's made, but I don't feel that it's, I don't feel like it really delivers.
Yeah, I would be willing to look at it again. I don't know if it's there or not. Like, I don't know if the Emperor has clothes or not.
I'll agree with that, but it wouldn't be like, man, I really would like to figure that out.
It doesn't have that same kind of like seductive quality that a David Lynch movie does, where even when I'm not sure what I just saw, there is enough there that really wants me to decode it. Whereas this movie, it's like, well, at some point I'll catch up with it maybe on a second time, and or if I end up having a conversation with somebody else who's seen it, then we can kind of bounce ideas off each other. But yeah, I it feels a little empty ultimately. It feels like maybe it's a little bit more style than substance. But I liked that style quite a bit. And I like Toby Jones' performance in it, and I kinda like the world that it's set in. What are we watching next week?
What are we watching? Frankenstein's Army. This is what we're watching.
This was suggested by a group friend, like a back home friend.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
It's a Bender recommendation.
There's a shout out, John Bender.
Yeah. I'm very, very sure that it is more genre specific. I did a couple weeks back. I was looking at it, and I think it might be by a very similar studio to, or the same studio as that did Dead Snow. And so I'm vaguely interested, and I think it might be a big campy fun, and that's what I'm hoping from it. So
okay, so next week we'll be watching Frankenstein's Army. And if anybody has anything to say about that, or The Martian, or Sicario, or Barbarian Sound Studio, or anything else that we might have talked about in this episode, you can get in contact to us through jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. If you like us there, you can see when we post news items and be able to comment on those, or you can comment on the episodes. If you want us to read it on air, we will. And we'll also read your emails if you have anything you wanted to say. We're also available on Twitter @JabberPodcast. And I post episodes there as well. And, you know, we're reachable. And that's where I've been doing a lot of talking with the other podcasts and, you know, sort of the community of other podcasters that we're kind of getting to know. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Subscribe to us there. Leave us a one-sentence review and a star rating, and it helps other people find the show, and it makes our presence on those websites a little bit bigger, so please do that. And also, we are available under Zune and the Pocket Cast and Windows Podcast Network. We're pretty much everywhere you can find a podcast. And hopefully in the future we'll be even more places. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the content I've provided to the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. You can read Richard's scribblings that he's done over at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com. And be sure to check out Brad, Amanda, and Alyssa over at their podcast, Quarter Crisis. .podbean.com. Quarter Life Crisis is the name of the show. Go ahead and listen to Leland's podcast, Dampercast, over there in Olympia, Washington, and Patrick and his dad, Patrick Sr., over in Detroit at Make Dad Read Comics.
Almost educational, too.
Almost educational. I think we're both going to be doing some episodes separately with them. Yeah.
I should be on sometime at the end of October.
Yeah, you'll be on within the month, and I think my episode with them is going to be in November. That's Patrick's other podcast that he does with his other school teacher friend, and they kind of argue about, kind of like what we do with the pet topic. Well, it's not just related to movies. It's related to society, politics, science, literature, whatever. And we're going to be talking about two separate topics, so we'll let you know more about that when we know more about it. Yep. But until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Yeah, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.